Okay, well, hi. Here we are in the green room,
Is
where
this actually green?
It is, in fact, green.
It is.
Well, sort of. Variety of greens, blues, and
other colours. And a lot of skulls.
And a lot of skulls, yes. Yeah. Well, that's a tradition. That's a South African tradition.
They were actually whole heads before the festival started.
Yeah. It's been so
sweet. The flesh has dropped off, as is so many of us, after this running back and forth between festivals. I must say, I do admire when I walk down the street and I see people who are, I mean, probably reaching retirement age, but motoring down. You know that walk?
Yes, yes.
And you walk really fast.
Yeah.
You look like sort of a little train engine.
It's a Frantic thing.
And I think
or
it's really marvelous.
People are so
determined to get to the next. I mean, I'm working, so of course I've got to get to the next thing and sort of put it down to work. But I mean,
I've always loved those involuntarily times at Frantic when people burst out, and then as they're walking, they're talking, saying, "Did you? What did
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did you hear what? And
have 5 minutes
to
process.
Yeah, and it's just lovely, kind of like birds. All
but
just
you know, it is a very unique atmosphere at Frantic because obviously you know we all go to mystery festivals all over the world, and this is genuinely, I would say, the friendliest, because there's a sense that all the authors and the booksellers and the publishers and the audiences are equal and all in it together. So when you come, you go down the street, people stop you all the time, everybody's smiling. And it isn't always like that at literary festivals.
Oh, really?
There's quite a big divide between the authors who are kept corralled over there and the audiences. So it's just a joy here, although it takes you 45 minutes
to get there. It really does.
Because everybody said, "Oh, I was just in your session and my mum would like to say hello." It was like,
it's really the.
I mean, but it's great.
The fastest distance between two points here is not the direct.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's right.
Not the direct route.
Pass from some gardens and you'll get there.
Yeah. Jump over a hedge.
We're on the back. Yeah.
We once had to pull a poet out from under a hedge.
Poets for you.
Only once. I find it hard to believe it was only once.
All of the things that have gone on in this mad, placid village over the festival honestly will curl your hair.
Right.
Yes, there's one pub called, it was always called the Elephant, and now they've changed the name, and I refuse to call it by its new name. It always just has to be
Will
the
always
Elephant.
Be the Elephant,
right?
Yeah.
No matter
to you,
to me, no matter what, no matter what they call it going into the future.
No, that's right. It can't be. No, we have in the UK, we have it used to be a chain, which is not like your Woolworths, which is like our Marks and Spencers, of course. Our Woolworths was the place you went to buy your aunt and uncle liqueur chocolate, you know, that had been encrusted for many, many years. It's really, really cheap. And the town I live in, Chichester, Woolworths closed 25 years ago. Every single person says, "I'll pick you up at the back of Woolworths." It will never go.
Never go. It has to be the same place.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway. That was a diversion.
Sorry. Okay, did you go to any sessions other than the ones where you were speaking?
No, because my publishers have filled every waking hour, which is brilliant, but with other stuff. So I haven't been able to get into any other sessions. And apart from anything else, the festival's done so amazingly with the audiences. It's full.
Mm.
I mean, it's really, really fun. I thought, you know, you could just wave your lanyard and swan in and out. And you can't. There's standing room only in a lot of lot of events. So it's, but I'm very keen. I'm going to go and see Tony Park later. I really love his books. And I was chatting to fantastic Dion Mayer last night, and I said, "Well, I'm coming to your session." And he said, "Well, that'd be great, Kate, but it's in Afrikaans." I was like, "Oh, okay. Maybe I won't. Maybe, you know, atmosphere is all very well, but not for an hour.
Yes,
not having any Afrikaans." So, and John Boyne is a really good friend of mine, and we have missed each other every single day so far.
Mm-hmm.
So my, you know, task, should I choose to accept it today, is to find John Boyne.
Right.
Which I would like
just to follow the crowds.
Yeah, follow the
fast walking crowds, the massive crowds.
And you, Paige, did you do sessions other than yours?
I did on the Friday. I did two. I did Femme Fatale, which was with Gail Schimmel and Danielle Weekly, which was fantastic. And I also did a Dion Chang AI panel, which was fascinating.
I'd love to.
It was really good. And the one thing that stuck out to me that really stayed with me is they asked, how can we use AI to make Africa more successful? And the one response, which was great, was that we have 31% of arable land, farmable land in South Africa, and it's one of the biggest, we have one of the biggest farmable land in the world, and we don't use it. We underutilize it. We shouldn't be importing anything.
So AI is going to fall.
They're saying we need. Yeah, well, there you go.
Well, no, AI.
Maybe the next generation.
Land. That's the. It's that's true. The dark side of it.
Yes, and a lot of water.
A lot of water. One AI search is the equivalent in energy to 300 Google searches, and to do one single LLM, that is the equivalent of two round the world trips on a huge. So there's a massive environmental issue.
Yes, a friend of mine was saying that she started saying thank you to her ChatGPT, which she's very fallen in love with her ChatGPT, and she started to say thank you. I said, please don't. It's very expensive every time you every time you do that. Rather be a little ruder and save us all a little something. Yeah, just be blunt.
Catch. I mean, I've posed that question. Does one say thank you to your chatbot, ChatGPT?
So I've never used it.
Okay.
I mean, I'm because I'm very involved in the UK in the campaign to protect copyright, which is being this is the issue for writers, actually. And I think a lot of writers are not yet understanding quite how devastating it is. So there are brilliant things about AI and incredibly important. And I think in industry and health and all of that. But generative AI, which is theft, is very, very significant. And you now can't avoid it. So it's like the early days of traffic when suddenly people had cars and they realized they were going to have to put some systems in place. Otherwise, all the cars were going to hit each other. We are there with AI. Actually, we're probably past that with AI. So in the UK, all the artists are united. It's been an extraordinary thing. And I'm finding myself in, you know, discussions with Elton John and Paul McCartney. I mean, literally across the board, all the artists are going to the UK government. You're rewarding illegality. You're rewarding law breaking
and making it easy and making it as easy as humanly and robotically possible
work, to steal work. So I mean that is such an interesting. I would love to have heard it because I lived my life
phenomenal. It was absolutely fantastic. My brain wasn't just I was taking as many notes as I could. I felt my brain wasn't big enough to hold everything all at once. A friend of mine, her daughter's in her final year of school, and I had dinner with her, and she was saying she's very worried about her daughter's results because she's realized only just recently that her daughter's been studying using ChatGPT and she's been enabling it, and then she kind of realized that it's not really accurate.
It's not accurate.
And I had this idea about this future generation of all these young people who are finishing school believing in this fake future or this fake history. Sorry. So they all go into the world thinking that they've studied and that they know things, but it's all slightly inaccurate.
And so superficial.
But also with all the inbuilt bias. I mean, that's the other thing. So, you know, I did, I was going on the radio to do something about AI. So I thought, well, I'll do just a test on this. And I looked up for a particularly big literary prize, not my one, not the Women's Prize, another one, say who has won it more than once. And I knew the answer, so I wanted to see what came up. And for the men, there were whole paragraphs. For the women, there was a line each.
Wow.
So there's a lot a lot going on. And I read somebody said a brilliant thing the other day. He said, like, using AI, ChatGPT, to do your work for you is like paying somebody else to go to the gym.
Yeah.
I thought, yes.
Yeah, that's it. That's a amazing. Fantastic image. That's wonderful.
Because it's like you want the results.
Yeah.
But you're not prepared to put the work in.
Yeah. Yes.
So it's
not sustainable. It's just not sustainable.
It's not sustainable. No, it's not sustainable. But, you know, we know it's just follow the money. That's all that's what it's about. It's what about, of course, freedom of speech and information.
If we could actually turn the tide.
We can't. We can't, but we can become more knowledgeable and and use some things and refuse to go the whole way. You know, it's the same with anything. You know, we all want a justice system that works, but well, personally, me, I don't want to execute people. You know, so it's like you decide where the line in the sand
your
is.
Version.
But, but we've all got to do this now, I think. Anyway,
but we need help from above. We really do, and you've got to trust your
as opposed to from below, which is what we're currently getting.
Yes, that's it. So we do need help to resist it.
But you know, the biggest thing, and that's one of the joys about being at Franschhoek, is that firstly, you do, you know, panels with other people, you listen to other people, you have totally different points of view, which is one of the things that I think all authors love going to literary festivals for. But it's also, you start to see complicated issues from different points of view, which might not be your own. And I think this kind of very good-natured, but really intellectually charged melting pot that there is in Franschhoek is it's really quite special because the panels are all very different. It's not just one, you know, I speak as a novelist as well as a non-fiction writer. It's not just one novelist after another talking about their book. It's discussion from different people. So I did a panel with Sifiwe, and we have our books, our writing has very little in common, really. Our backgrounds, our experiences, where how we've got to this place. But we both found ourselves having an amazing conversation about King Solomon's Mines, which we both had had a relationship with that, and then stood back and went, oh, my God.
You're the writer Haggard novel.
Yeah, because it's what my dad used to read to me when I was little in the 1960s, you know. And and then that totally different point of view, the two of us. We could have done a whole hour just on different readings of classic text when you stand back and you realise quite how awful that classic text is, you know, that sort of thing. So I could just stay in front of you forever, really, but I've got to go home.
There's so many overlaps. Sorry, Paige, so many overlaps. So I'm about to interview Ted Borta about his book about a filmmaker in Johannesburg in the turn of the last century. And King Solomon's Mines was one of the films he made.
Wow.
And in fact, Johannesburg rivaled Hollywood. In fact, it was bigger
for a brief moment.
Just a flicker of an eye.
At some point, has Johannesburg not rivaled any country in the world? It's had its moment. Every single bit of a hillbrow of New York.
Absolutely.
Right. No, you're so right. Yeah. And then yesterday I was talking to Peter Godwin. We had a virtual interview and we were talking about PTSD, which is what he deals with partly in his book. And I said, well, you know, it's still very much here for South Africans. It's very much still a thing. I said, in fact, there's just down the road, there's another panel discussing PTSD, you know, it's still very much with us.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was thinking about Hollywood on the felt. And I thought, I don't know if Ted's going to end up back in Joburg, but I thought it would be so nice to like go up the hill where the wild, you know, the hillside that leads up to the wilds. And I mean, could you stand there and say, look out across what is now Killarney, Revere, et cetera, and say, okay, this is where the studio was. Yep. This is where they shot. Because they also, apart from King Solomon's Mines, they shot a story about, a movie about the Great Trek.
Which
was, I mean, essentially a propaganda for cause of that. Essentially became propaganda for, you know, for the next white nationalist regime. But you kind of want to look out across there and say, you know, movies are fantasy. So you want to be able to say, okay, which part of this landscape was pretending to be, know, KwaZulu-Natal as, well, it wasn't that then, but, you know,
Zululand. This is Blood River.
Exactly. Where's Blood River? Exactly. Where's Blood River from here? You know, sort of made me think of the interesting things about, you know, about writing fiction.
Yes.
You've written something that's based on your, you know, your actual real experience of running an online book club.
You're right.
I mean, you've written a lot of things that's not based on, you know, being murdered as a Cathar heretic.
I write imagined characters against the backdrop of real history. Right. So I put the real history in terms of its facts and research on the page. You know, it's the Cathar heresy, the Huguenot diaspora.
Right.
But my characters are imagined.
Right.
So they are, that is like the film set, the real history is there. It's like the architecture. And then the characters, the actors, they come on and they do their thing and they say their words. So that's how I always think about it. You know, the history is accurate. It's researched. I lecture on these subjects in a you know, more professorial way. But the story itself, story is made up.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it's fascinating when you do return to the actual history or the relics of the history and so forth. I remember, I think one of the reasons that I read Labyrinth, I think it was your first novel, right?
It was my fifth book, actually. I was an overnight success in the middle of my
40s.
Okay. It's an overnight success.
It's the first one.
Hardworking, yeah.
Quite. I was partly interested in it because I had been to
Carcassonne.
To Carcassonne and to Montségur and to
those
fascinating places. And I was sort of, you know, immediately, you know, I mean, you go to places like that, you kind of feel the weight of history. I don't know where you know where it is. It's just like,
do you know,
it's, you know, hill.
Shell's interviewed me many times.
She has. She knows. Have you been to Montségur?
No, I haven't.
It's such a weird place. You know, you kind of feel, you almost feel like it's haunted with the ghosts of all these cathars.
It's the echoes in the landscape in the southwest of France are very strong. But they are, you know, in various places. And for me, it's always what I call the whispering in the landscape, that I arrive in certain places. And then there's a sense that if I just look out of the corner of my eye, I could see someone there waiting for me. And this is exactly what happened to me in Franschhoek. You know, the reason that I'm here now is because I had that experience in Franschhoek 13 years ago.
Is it like catching a ghost?
It was exactly that. I was in the Huguenot graveyard. I didn't know anything about the French history, despite my reading of Writer Haggard when I was younger. I'd somehow passed me by that bit of it. And I was completely blown away by the story of this kind of handful, really, hundreds of refugees, dispossessed, traumatized, PTSD people who'd arrived here. But that's just interest. I'm really curious. I like history. But then I went into the graveyard. And firstly, they look like the mountains of southwest France, the French mountains. It's a similar light. It's a similar kind of chiseled outline, if you like. But more, when I'm standing in the graveyard, I had this very, very clear image of a woman in 19th century clothes leaning forward to rub the lichen from a grave to see the name written there.
Oh, wow.
And then saw a hand come down on the back of her head. And I've spent 13 years writing books to find out who that woman was. And finally, in my last book, The Map of Bones, which is all set here in Franschhoek and Stellenbosch in the 17th and 19th centuries, I learned who she was. It's taken me 13 years to find out.
To find her.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
The ghosts have spoken.
The ghosts have spoken. Tapped you on the shoulder.
Michelle, what's your favourite sessions apart from the ones so far, apart from the ones you officiated?
Well, there was only one, but I haven't been able to get you any others, I'm sorry to say.
What, you're sitting in the green room drinking?
Well, there is a wine sponsor. What can we
there
say?
There is a wine sponsor. From under the
No, I've been working, writing a piece.
Right.
But today I've got the two. The second one is with a man, Costa Iotis. And the origin story of his book is his most wonderful book about growing up Greek in Kempton Park, which is a part of Johannesburg.
Rough.
It is what it sounds like.
Kempton Park, just near there. And I absolutely love it because Johannesburg is a story like New York. Everybody comes from somewhere a lot. And Kempton Park, so the immigrants were coming to South Africa from Greece and from Italy and from all over. They all started off in Hillbrow. Hillbrow just hummed with new arrivals. And then as they got established, then they would move to the suburbs. And that was a huge thing, to be able to move to the suburbs. And the Iotises were able to move to Kempton Park, where they, and this is in the 60s, you know, before, I mean, that's when olive oil, my mother used to keep in the medicine cabinet.
Yes.
So it's a lovely, I love these mosaics of different lives in South Africa, different identities, different, and this is just another really special.
We once worked with a very famous South African director, Keith Rose. He passed away, and he was super famous, and we worked with him once, and he had this very strong accent, and my partner, Karen, my art director, said to him, "Where are you from, Keith, in Joburg?" And he said, Santon. He said, "No, before that."
So true.
It is true. It kind of makes me feel a bit funny because I'm a Joburger born and bred. But I mean, obviously, you know, the family came from other places. My father from the Cape. It's often a little, I kind of often have that kind of sense of the sort of ghostliness of some of these spaces here in the Cape.
It's interesting to me.
Family.
Yes. Yeah. So interesting to me about Joburg is that, it has so many difficulties right now, and people are leaving. It's a very difficult place to live. But we all have such a love affair with it, despite the difficulties of now and forever, I guess. But there's this romantic, it's an incredibly romantic city, despite being the most unromantic city possibly in the world. But we really have such a romantic notion of it. Just when you're talking about it in your past, all of us.
That's interesting. And do you think it's like the deep belief in the city it could be again?
Oh, yes.
Is that presumably that makes, you know, because any of us who have a really strong sense of home, whatever the home is actually like at the particular time, we're very lucky.
Yeah.
Because for a lot of people, they don't have a sense of home. They're looking for a new home or they've got to find one. So,
I mean, I think that's right. Do you feel that? You're more a Joburg native.
I do, but the ambivalences are so deep that I wonder sometimes. I mean, yes, it's home, but I think, you know, at the moment I'm sort of battling, as many people in Joburg are, with the gap between your idealized version of this place that has been your home and the wonderful times you've had and so forth. And then, you know, daily you're facing the sort of reality of, you know, the great gaping pothole in your road that you have to avoid every day.
But also, as Johannesburgers, we tend to find beauty
Yes.
Where one wouldn't, if, I mean, from a little, if you're living in Cape Town, because that's all just so, whereas we have kind of a narrower focus and something, a tree in blossom now coming out or something.
That's so,
so
true.
So we find pockets of real beauty. Mm-hmm.
That's so true.
In Johannesburg.
That's a very good
because
point.
That's so trained, true.
We're trained to, we're not overwhelmed by the
So you're looking at the detail.
Yes.
You know, you're looking at the stitching rather than the tapestry. Yes.
Precisely.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you find that little space. I mean, I get so much out of just taking the dog to the park because it's a lovely park, Emerentia, with the botanical gardens, the dog, you know, and even when there's like, you know, rubbish flowing down the flowing down the river or they're trying to clear the dam of all the duck shit or whatever, you know, exactly. You still, you find your focus. You say, okay, well, I'm following the dog there. Wow. That's, you know, and you love it.
Yeah. That's
and you're right. That's exactly what it is. In Cape Town, you always feel like the beauty becomes kind of oppressive.
Right.
In a way. It does to me. Because I mean, it's just think, I did spend part of my childhood in Cape Town because that's, you know, where my father comes from. And, you know, we had to sort of do the ritual family visits to places like, you know, Duval Park that have a, you know, part of our family history. And maybe that's part of the reason that I often found, you know, that great bloody mountain looming over you, you know.
How dare it.
Exactly. You know, you go over Kloof Neck, you say, look at that beautiful sparkling sea. And I go,
Too much beauty.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, make space in your life, a little ugliness, please.
Yeah, yes. You know. That was exactly, you know, when I was writing The Map of Bones, so the first bit, you know, it's all set in this part of the world. Mm. And, you know, I obviously have a European character, because I could have her on a ship seeing Table Bay and Table Mountain for the first time, because you can't do that if you're native, as it were. If it's where you live and you've got, you know, you're used to the great mountain hovering over you all the time. But if you're European, you've never seen something like that. And all the sailors have told you about it. So that's a way when you're looking newly as an outsider, which obviously I am completely looking as an outsider on this beautiful part of the world. For me, everything is extraordinary and magnificent. And I don't know Joburg very well. I've only been a couple of times for book festivals. I know Franschhoek very well now and Cape Town a bit. So it's a very different experience when you have outsider eyes.
But at the same time, your outsider eyes make us look closer and give us a closer understanding of the Huguenots. And it's a bloody history. I was honestly quite taken aback by the blood, you know,
violence. Brutal times, really brutal times.
I think that's history in general.
Well, I think so.
I mean, it's all blood and irony. Yeah. That's
history. Blood and ivory.
Although there's one notorious thing in the whole Wars of Religion, though, in France, which is just very, very funny, which is there was a moment in Amsterdam where power passed from the Catholics to the Protestants. You know, Huguenots are just the French name for their Protestants, and they were mostly called Calvinists in Netherlands. And every other part of the Wars of Religion is just bodies piled high. In Amsterdam, which had been under Catholic control for 40 years, power swapped in the space of an afternoon and nobody was killed.
Gosh.
Wow. And I said to my Dutch friends at one moment,
Why
was it that nobody was dying? And they said, Kate, we would not disrupt trade. Like this religious stuff's all very but we don't want the bottom line to be affected. And it was so true. It was like, okay, we orderly now. They just put all the Catholic priests, they put all the burghers, they put them on ships and put them into exile. That was the end of that. And then it's like, oh, I'll move my pencils in now. It was hilarious.
That's wonderful.
Brilliant.
Oh,
that's great.
Well, thank you so much. It was delightful to see you. I'm going to wrap up.
We're just getting started.
I know. It was lovely to talk to you. And I hope, sounds like you had a wonderful festival, which is very nice. I've had a lot of fun. So great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sure.